Basic Brewing Radio is brought to you by Imperial Yeast. I'm looking forward to warmer temperatures for several reasons, not the least of which is hot porch fermentation with Imperial A37 Pog, the current seasonal yeast from Imperial. Pog is Ebergarden Kvik, known to produce a huge tropical ester profile. At higher temperatures, you get pineapple and guava aromas, and at the lower end of the range, you get more delicate citrus, peach, and kiwi. I plan to use it for a hoppy raw ale inspired by my chat with Mika Leitinen. And, of course, I'm not dusting off my stir plate, thanks to those 200 billion cells in each easy-to-open package. Ask your local homebrew store about A37 Pog from Imperial, and check out all the dependable deliciousness at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we head to my hometown of Hot Springs, Arkansas, for the 4th American Craft Sake Festival. Ben Bell of Origami Sake in Hot Springs gives us a masterclass in sake as he gives us a guided tasting of American and Japanese sake breweries. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters will see an early release this week and a behind-the-scenes video of the next video episode. It's the one where Steve Wilkes and I taste the Veneer Mead Kit, the ingredient kit, the one-gallon kit that I bought from Groenfeld.com. Super easy to put together and delicious as well. I need to get another one of those kits. That was a delicious mead, and it's all gone. Many, many thanks to our new Patreon members and those who have stepped up their membership level on Patreon. I told Steve the other day, I feel like we're going back into public radio, just like in college. That's okay. Thanks to your help, we'll keep headed down the track. Have more episodes in the can already, and more are planned. Lots of great content in the pipeline. Pipeline down the track. How many metaphors can I twist? Anyway, as always, I'm very, very grateful for your help. Heartbreaking news from Tulsa. Desiree and Dave of High Gravity announced on Facebook that March 30th will be their last day in business. They've served the homebrewing and craft beer people of Tulsa and across the country for 20 years. But financial factors have become too much. Desiree and Dave are true friends. Of course, we'll stay in touch. They can't get rid of us that easily. So I'm so grateful for all the support and advice that they've given me over the years, in addition to their financial support of this show. I still can't believe it. It's like I say, it's heartbreaking to see good friends go through something like this. So send some positive vibes to Desiree and Dave and their family as they make the transition to the next chapter. And we love you guys, of course. On another sort of depressing note, on the latest Brewlosophy podcast, Marshall and Will share their opinions about the current state of the AHA. I think Marshall and Will need to hire a Holly to join them. I'm sure that joke has already been made. Anyway, they had some interesting thoughts about the current state of the AHA, some that I share, others not. But it's good to get other perspectives from other folks and to hear that conversation about what's going on with our beloved hobby. Thanks to Marshall for the shout-out to us on that episode, and as always, for being at the forefront of homebrewing experimentation, Marshall and his team. A bit of a downer leading into this really fun episode. Sorry about that. About a year ago, we met Ben Bell and Justin Potts of Origami Sake in Hot Springs for a pre-production tasting. Well, since then, their sakes have hit the retail shelves and restaurants across the state, and they had the honor this year of hosting the 4th Annual American Craft Sake Festival. It's a big deal. When Kelly and I walked up to the tasting tent, I was not sure how we were going to make this show happen. There was a ton of people inside tasting the 20 sake breweries represented, And a lot of the breweries only had maybe the brewer and maybe one more other person to serve samples and to chat to participants. And I didn't know how we were going to sneak in there and steal some of their time. But Ben Bell came to the rescue. He took us behind the scenes around the outside of the tent to get us some samples and to help us snag some interviews as well. And at the same time, Ben basically gave us a master class on tasting sake. Sake ingredients, and sake brewing techniques. So I'm very grateful to Ben for making this show happen and taking time away from this event that, you know, they were hosting. So we start out in the first couple of minutes close to the drummers, so it's a little noisy, but we move on to the quieter areas as we work our way around the tent. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Ben Bell of Origami Sake. Welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio, first of all.
Thank you. So wonderful to be back on the show after about a year, right?
Yeah, it's almost exactly a year. I think the show ran in March of last year. How's the past year been treating you?
Well, so, of course, we are at the American Craft Sake Festival, which is for the first time here in Arkansas and in Hot Springs, and I feel like that's a sign of the progress that we've made. We are in the market selling and making and selling sake in Arkansas, and the response has been great.
Yeah, I've been able to purchase it myself up in northwest Arkansas, and it makes a great gift, by the way.
Oh, so I'm so happy to hear that, because one of the ideas was, especially if you are from Arkansas, this is a great local thing made with Arkansas rice that kind of puts on a good face to give as gifts to people in the state and outside of the state.
And you can be selfish and get some for yourself, too, though.
That's right, yeah. I drink plenty of my own sake, for sure.
So what's the reception been?
The reception has honestly beaten my expectations. Of course, the dream always is to get sake outside of just traditional Japanese and Asian restaurants. And we already have our sake at wine bars, at southern restaurants, at pizza places. And it feels like the more we pour it and the more people taste it, the response has been, I can see myself drinking sake now. So that's the dream.
Tell me about this event. You've got 20 sake brewers from. I got a couple emails last time. You and I were, and Kelly were drinking some sake, and you know, my southern accents slipped in a couple of times during the interview. But you've got 20 sake brewers from what, across the United States and around the world?
That's right. We have a few from Japan as well. So and I do believe we have one from Canada. So yeah, it's a pretty diverse group of brewers, of course, mostly representing like what is happening with sake making outside of Japan and kind of seeing the craft come up and mature in the U.S. So yeah, that's the thrust of the theme for our brewers.
So some people say that craft beer is kind of either stagnant or, you know, slipping a little bit as other, you know, people are turning their attention to other beverages. Are you hoping that sake is going to be one of those that's going to be now beginning more attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of a coincidence, really. You know, craft beer has been pretty mature for a while now, and definitely the idea with craft sake was it hasn't had its real boom time yet, and it really feels like that time is coming. And of course, I don't want sake to be a fad. I want it to, you know, have real staying power. So I hope we join the ranks of beer and wine and spirits, you know, everywhere you normally would go and have drinks.
So I'm looking, and the tent is it's full of people right now. There's a great response. So as we wander in there, what should we be looking for? What are we going to see? I mean, I'm a sake novice still. So what should we be looking for? What kinds of varieties of different things are we going to see?
Well, I think the best thing is to see, like you're seeing in real time, what is happening from the brewers themselves who are here pouring sake. You can really get a snapshot going from table to table of, you know, the ideas and the styles that people are thinking about and making reality. So, you know, to me, that's one of the big takeaways. And yeah, it's really worth saying the person who's pouring the sake for you today is probably one of the people who made it. So just to meet them, to know these people, to put you know, a face to the brand, I think that's one of the main things.
So with sake, are we going to see sort of the Americanization of the beverage, you know, are we going to see American brewers putting their own spin on the genre, so to speak, and is that frowned upon or is that encouraged?
You know, I've gotten this question about what is the American style of sake or what will be the American style of sake for probably over a decade, usually from Japanese brewers or maybe Japanese sake fans, and there's never really been a clear answer to that because it's so new. I will say I think America will do its thing, and you know, you'll see maybe some unusual things, and I think you already see some very like bold styles of sake, and that's kind of our style at Origami as well. So I think it's still yet to be seen, you know, what will be an American style if there is one. But if you look historically at other categories, at beer, at wine and spirits, usually America comes up with something that we end up being known for. So I think it's coming. I just don't know exactly what it is yet.
Well, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to jumping in there. Thanks, Ben, and congratulations.
Absolutely. Enjoy.
Okay, so Ben, you sneaked us around, and here we're at your table. How about that?
Yeah, no surprise. I've taken you over to the place that serves our sake, and what I have for you is a very special release outside of our Thousand Cranes and White Lotus. I guess I shouldn't even say release because we haven't really released it. It's been kind of a successful, successful test batch that we feel confident that we're going to release. It doesn't really have a name, but I can tell you the key point about it is the koji, which you could call the malted rice that normally goes into a sake batch. Usually, only about 20% of the rice that you put in is the koji, malted rice. In this case, we upped it to 50%.
Wow.
And so you get a little bit more body, more sweetness, and a long finish. But I hope it's not over, you know, it's not too much in any regard. So we've been really happy with the results for this.
Yeah, I was going to say my first impressions, and again, I'm a sake novice, but I get a lot more rice. I mean, would that be good feedback?
I think it is. Yeah, I think sometimes the rice can get lost in the fruity esters that are coming from the yeast. But this is a good mix of all those things. So the rice, kind of cereal malty rice components are there. It's kind of integrated with the, you know, fruit from the yeast that we use. This is a very famous yeast strain from Japan called Brewers Association 901. It's one of the most historically famous sake brewing yeast strains, and it does give some fruity esters. So yeah, you kind of get all of that together with, I would say, just like a little bit more body and intensity than you normally do with, kind of lower koji sakes or standard koji sakes.
Yeah, on the front end, of course, it's very bright and, I guess alcoholic in a good way. You can tell it's a strong beverage. But it's very floral on the front end, but on the back end there's a sort of darker, earthier, grainier flavor that lingers on. So you know there's like a spectrum of flavors that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's worth saying some of the complexity. That koji, it's breaking down starches into fermentable sugars, but it's also breaking down proteins into amino acids. And that gives the classic umami base that all sake has. Worth saying, that's the base for making soy sauce and miso. All of those involve growing koji in some sense. So just the fact that it's creating those amino acids, it's giving you some of that nice savory complexity as well.
I totally get that. It's the umami on the I have umami on my back end. No, it's really, really good. So do you anticipate releasing this?
I think we're going to put it out as a special release, and then we get to see people's kind of how much they like it out in the wild, if you will. And then if people really like it and we feel confident about making this over and over again, then it will be hopefully a regular Origami release.
Excellent. Well, it's delicious. So let's find something else.
Okay, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, Ben, we're on the if not the world tour, the North American tour of the sakes here. Who are we tasting?
Absolutely. So this is a sake that is near and dear to my heart. It is from Japan. It's a brand called Nanbu Bijin. And this is the brewery that I trained at for two seasons in Japan, where I learned almost everything I know about making sake. So our Thousand Crane sake is sort of based off of the sake that you're tasting now. But actually, to your question about the American style, this is Thousand Cranes is sort of a bigger in every way version compared to this sake, which is still fruit forward. But really, to me, it's a little bit more precise and elegant and balanced on a slightly smaller scale, but I hope still delicious too, I think.
Yeah, it's really good. It's I guess clean. Is that a good adjective?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I say precise, elegant, clean as well. It's really just sort of like very dialed in fruitiness, really lovely. It's not meant to be there. I think there is some umami here, but it's a little bit underneath. But it's meant to be like a delicious kind of clean, refreshing beverage that also would pair with a very wide range of foods. So the category is Tokubetsu Junmai, which means special Junmai. There's a couple ways to get that, but basically it just means a little bit more care. It was put into this sake. I can tell you it is made with locally grown rice called Ginotome. And I know this well because in between brewing seasons, I worked for the farming co-op that grew this rice. So yeah, I did a little farming work while I was in Japan as well in the summer.
Very nice. Well, as a brewer, that's got to connect you more to the product.
I think that was a special experience to be able to live in Japan and work at a sake brewery. But to work at the farm, see the rice go from seeds to seedling to growing in the field, and then seeing that rice come into the brewery the next season, I feel like that was a truly unique special experience.
Would you call this a palate cleanser?
I would. I would say the aromatic intensity is, I think, it's a little higher than normal, so you do get a lot of those fruity esters. I think if you really wanted this to be like the palate cleanser, you could bring those down even further. But I think it does a little bit of both. It's a really lovely sake, but also, yeah, it does do some of that nice palate cleansing action as well, and that's some of the acidity that is coming in on the finish.
Now, in beer brewing, you can use temperature to control fruitiness or fruity esters with certain yeasts. Are the same dynamics working here?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally, the Japanese sake yeast strains that are known to make a lot of fruity esters, you brew those at low temperatures. So it's usually low and slow fermentation, and that gets you to this really nice concentration of fruity esters. Yeah, it's a big part of it. And really, in the progression of isolating strains of yeast that are used now all over the country, historically in Japan, you can look at that progression and you can kind of see that each new strain that was isolated over, let's say, the past like 80, 90 years, kind of gets a little bit more fruity, more obviously fruity, and ferments at lower temperatures.
Interesting. That's counterintuitive. Like I say, with the beer brewing, as I'm sure especially some like Belgian yeast strains, the higher the temperature, the more fruity esters, the more, but I guess it would... Maybe different yeasts, different strokes for different yeasts.
It actually is a very different yeast strain. And we just had here, as a part of the festival, we had a brewer-focused series of talks this morning. And one person gave a talk about the relationship between Japanese sake yeast and the Koji mold. And I did not know this, but actually the Japanese sake yeast really is its own species of Saccharomyces. It's Saccharomyces sake. And it diverged from Saccharomyces... I'm going to butcher this name, Cerevisiae?
Close enough.
Yeah. A long time ago, and it really is quite different.
Huh. So in addition to all the fun that we're having here today, this is a working weekend for y'all, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's not often that, so many sake brewers outside of Japan can get together, see each other, and talk. So we always want to take some amount of time to... kind of talk with each other at the brewing level, more technical level. I will say doing that for a brewer at 8 in the morning after maybe going out and enjoying some of our beverages, doing some sensory analysis, if you will. It's a tall order, but we're game for it.
I've been the moderator of panels at HomebrewCon at 8 o'clock in the morning, so I feel your pain.
Yeah, so it's a lot of raspy voices and sleepy eyes. Yeah.
All right, Ben, what's next? Let's find something else. What are we tasting now, Ben?
Okay, so now we are tasting one of my absolute favorite sake breweries and dear friends, Brooklyn Kura. I'm going to say one of the best sake breweries outside of Japan, easily. Also makes really lovely, you know, ostensibly fruit-forward style of sake, which I do think is like a real crowd-pleaser style, and it's a great introduction into the world of craft sake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I tasted this, and it was like, oh, yeah, that's fruit. There's a ton of fruit.
Now, I will say this is their Daiginjo, and Junmai Daiginjo, and what that means is the rice was milled to at least 50%, which gives you, right off the bat, a more delicate, refined style, and usually the what this is combined with is a strain of yeast that gives those really nice fruity esters. You put that together, and this is usually a show-off style to really show, like, what can the brewery do.
Yeah, this is the New England IPA of sake so far for me. You know, it's the fruit, very fruit-forward, but at the same time, I do get the rice on the background as well.
Absolutely. I will say, I just got this right now, having a sip. It's been a little bit. There is some wonderful rice maltiness that kind of comes in after that initial fruit. I think that is a really wonderful combination. I will say, normally you don't get that so much in the Daiginjo, because when you polish down a grain of rice, you're taking fats and proteins off the outside that can give you more of those deep umami flavors. And what you're left with is more pure starch. I'm getting some of that nice riciness that you usually get when you don't polish down or mill down so far. It's a really nice, full offering. You get the fruitiness, you get the rice, cereal, rice, malty graininess as well. Yeah, all really well integrated too.
So when you talk about beer, you talk about the balancing characteristics of malt sweetness, hop bitterness, also sort of an astringency or a roastiness, a bitterness from the grains as well. You get characteristics from the yeast. You know, there's a balancing act between those, you know, several legs of the table, so to speak. What are the legs of the table that you're balancing when you're coming up with a sake?
Yeah, that's so really good question. And it really is a different kind of palette of things that you're normally balancing. So astringency generally in sake is considered to be something that to avoid. If you get that, that's usually, it's not a great sign in the world of sake. And bitterness, honestly, is sometimes, in rare occasions, can be good. But in general, what you're playing with is sweetness. You're playing with umami. And that I think, is like a kind of a different part of that equation in this particular category. And, of course, tart acidity. So those are the three real pillars. And then when you get into talking about styles, and we're getting into not so much things you're tasting on the tongue, but, you know, aromas that maybe you're processing as taste. Now we're into the world of the fruity esters as well. So, you know, it's worth saying, you can use a strain of yeast that gives no fruity esters at all, and you can really make that sake about the flavor of the rice. Or you can use a strain of koji malt that really breaks down a lot of proteins into savory amino acids, and you can get a sake that really truly shows off the flavor of umami. Which is its own wonderful thing, and it's kind of unique in the world of alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what was the balancing point, because we're getting the fruitiness from the yeast, we're getting in this one the graininess, the maltiness from the rice, and I was like, well, what is it? It's not bitterness,
yeah.
But I guess is it tartness that's balancing that for me.
So I would say really your big two for balance is sweetness and tart acidity. That's where you're at. Of course, we're not adding something that would, bitterness can be a great balancer for sweetness, right? But we, in this case, we don't really have a source of bitterness that does that balancing. And like I said, sometimes you can find it. Very, rarely that does enter the picture and it becomes a part of it. I will say sake can go to very high alcohol levels as well. So you could potentially have, and AB, the way we tasted sake yesterday as part of a sake course that I gave, the ABV, a natural ABV of 19%. And you're going to, there's no way you're not going to get some alcohol bite. But the interesting thing about that is you can use that alcohol bite to balance some sweetness. So it helps do a little bit of that cutting in addition to your tart acidity. But basically, sweetness, tart, acidity is the main balance you're going for.
Excellent. I'm learning. Yeah. Let's find something else.
Sure.
Mark Isbell, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
All right, great to be here.
Now, as I understand it, you're one of the people responsible for the raw ingredient, one of the raw ingredients that goes into origami sake, right?
Yeah, our family farm, and we've got the whole family here today, grows the sake rice that's used by Origami Sake here in Arkansas. So we've got a totally Arkansas product, but we also sell to a number of breweries around the U.S. and in other countries, too.
Has your family been in rice farming for a while?
Yeah, we've been over 75 years in rice farming, and we've been growing Japanese varietals for 40 years, and sake rice for 25-plus.
Did you ever think back in the day that you would be producing rice for sake? Was that something that you ever thought would happen?
You know, I don't think we ever stopped to think of it. It was just always, what's the next step along this journey? We started off growing just normal table rice, and through the years it became an opportunity to grow Japanese sushi rice, and that eventually morphed into the sake rice from the knowledge and the experience we gained from that process.
So is it a different process growing these varieties from the typical American varieties?
It's similar in a lot of ways, but in some ways more risky. So the rice yields less, it falls over, and it's harder to harvest, and it's a niche market. So you have to produce specifically for your customer rather than just selling into the broader marketplace.
You see this as a growth area for farmers, or specifically for Arkansas farmers?
Yeah, I mean, it's still a small part of the broader portfolio of like people who buy rice, but it's definitely a growing trajectory for the sake industry in general. So our hope is that they continue to grow and that we can continue to supply into that. In addition to the farming of the rice, this year we actually opened the polishing facility where we take the rice and process it down to the specific requirements that the sake breweries have, which is pretty unique.
So you're getting some vertical integration.
Absolutely.
Do you get, as in brewing, in growing this specialty product, do you get to charge a premium for it over the American varieties that you're usually growing?
Yeah, just because of the risk factor and the challenges, it definitely demands a premium. And, you know, we try to keep that in a way that is still accessible to our customer, but it's absolutely necessary to have a certain amount of premium to make it viable on our end, too.
So are you a sake drinker?
Yeah, not every day. I don't drink anything every day, right? But at something like this, and when I do drink, sake is definitely one of the go-to beverages.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
So, Ben, you want to brag on the Isbells a bit?
Yeah, I do. I have to say there's a few things to know about the Isbell Farms and the family. In addition to growing Japanese strains of rice that are great for making sake, they are also always on best practices, lowering water usage in the field, lowering methane output, kind of multi-generational farm family doing innovation at every generation. I really look up to them, and I will say, if it wasn't for them growing sake rice in Arkansas, I don't know if Origami Sake would exist.
Oh, wow.
I first met Mark's dad, Chris Isbell, 15 years ago. I think my home brewing partner at the time found him online somehow and reached out to him, and he said, yeah, let's meet up. And we went to a catfish place like out in Arkansas rice country out in East Arkansas. And met up. He told us that he was growing a rice strain called Yamada Nishiki. It's one that's the people call it the king of sake rice. It is the most important sake rice varietal by far. And I have to say, you know, Mark mentioned he sells rice not just to Arkansas brewers, but around the country and outside of the country as well. they've been putting Arkansas on the map for sake way before we came along. So they've done a lot of the work.
Excellent. First, Ben, if you could introduce us.
So, yes, we are here with Mitsuhiro Kono from Ida Group, who their company does so many wonderful things with sake in Japan, and they're a big part of growing sake in the U.S. as well. And right now we are drinking a beer made with white koji, right?
So we are exporting the white koji from Japan now. And our company is operating the sake brewery, and so which is brewing beer as well. And so we are using this white koji for our product. And then, 10% of the grain bill is this white koji, which provides the citric acid in it. Very, very unique standard one. Yeah.
So how would you describe this style of beer? Is it?
Style is saison.
Oh, okay.
Saison, yeah. Yes. The saison is like a very refreshing, yeah, right? Yeah, so this citric acid is go well with this saison style. But currently, there are a lot of people, brewery people, is looking at the lager as well. Yeah, yeah.
No, I totally get it. The saison character comes through for me. When you said that, I was like, well, sure, because it's a farmhouse kind of flavor. It's not quite funky, but it's got an interesting yeast character that I could be talked into saying that it's a Belgian character. So is the koji used in converting the grain at any point, like, say, in the mash?
Yes, exactly. The koji has an enzyme in it. So that's why we are using the mashing process. Yeah. And then we are still challenging in the different way, like using the cold side. Yeah. So with this enzyme, make the beer more dry. Yeah. So this is a new challenge for us, but we are trying to develop this new ingredient for the beer.
Would this be suitable for, a dark? This is quite a light beer, in light in color.
Yes.
Would it be suitable for any, like, say, darker styles with any, you know, say, more roasted grains, do you think?
Oh, yeah. So a couple of years ago, so I worked with a home brew club. And so a lot of home brewers think of a lot of different way. And so one of my preferred style was porter. Oh, yeah. So they used the white koji for the porter, and it was so amazing. Yeah, I love it.
I love it. It's delicious. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you so much.
Good to meet you. So just to add on a little bit to what Kono-san said about this beer, the saison style made with white koji. So there's different kinds of koji spores. Actually, white koji is generally not used for making sake. It's used for making spirits like shochu. And the thing that white koji is known for, and there's another strain of koji that's known for this as well, is making a lot of citric acid. And I think when you get that really nice crispness, I think it augments this saison style, where this is like a particularly like crisp and refreshing saison. It's that citric acid from the koji kind of augmenting that, right? And, you know, Kono-san said, you know, part of the challenge that they're taking on is making this very nice dry style of beer. But I think that in this case, again, the tart acidity is helping sort of like dry it up. Even if there's some residual sweetness, you're not going to get as much of that impression because the acidity is so high.
Yeah, it's very nice. It is very dry, but at the same time, you know, between the higher carbonation level but there's also a graininess there as well that helps balance that. It's not watery at all, so it may be dry, low in finishing gravity, but it's not watery. It's very satisfying. I could drink pint after pint of this on the porch in the summertime. This would be delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, it's interesting to think about rice. It is, you know, koji mold grown on rice, but this isn't like as light as a rice lager, or it's, you know, it's bringing more to the table, right? And that's kind of the idea, is how can you present rice in a way where it's not subtractive from the flavor, it's adding things to the flavor. And using the white koji, I think, is really getting to that, where it's still really crisp and refreshing, but it's got some real character as well.
Yeah, usually when American brewers use rice, they're wanting to dry things out and sort of if anything, take away malt character. This adds something specific and unique.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we're of course talking a lot about sake and, you know, how rice is really interesting and bringing a lot on the sake side. But using koji, a very Japanese thing, this is showing you how rice can be additive in the beer world as well.
Delicious. Okay, Ben, introduce us.
So I'm here with one of my favorite people in the sake world, Byron Stitham, who is the owner and sake brewer at Proper Sake in Nashville, who I think does a really unique style that's really interesting, and it's showing some of the individual character that you will see in North America in terms of what do people want to make.
Welcome, Byron.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your sake brewery, first of all.
Yeah, so we're based in Nashville, Tennessee. We have about 13,000 liters capacity. Predominantly do Yamaha and Kimoto style sakes. And the flagship product is really kind of the marriage between Yamaha Umami and kind of slow, long, cold ferment Ginjo style. So trying to find that marriage between the two.
So when you think of Nashville, you think of hot chicken and sake. When you think of just like Hot Springs, Arkansas, maybe sake is not the first thing that would come to mind about Nashville. How did you get to Nashville, and what's the response to the Nashville audience, your market, for sake?
I think Nashville's in a pretty good place right now because it's been growing pretty rapidly over the last few years. And as such, we're getting a lot of transplants from all over the country. So generally speaking, people are pretty eager to try anything new. And certainly what we are doing is a little bit all over the place. But we have a bar in East Nashville where we not only serve our sakes, but we do Japanese sakes. We're really trying to push the envelope on fermentation and cocktails and beer culture as well. Ultimately, the goal is really just to get people in the door to try sake.
This is delicious, what I'm tasting. It's... and my sake vocabulary, I can't even say the word, so my sake vocabulary is kind of just in its infancy right now. So I may be using beer terms, but I see this as kind of fruit forward, fairly substantial mouthfeel. It's bold, whereas one of the ones that we tasted, the second one we tasted, was kind of delicate, and I said that it was almost a palate cleanser. This is like a main course. this is a delicious. Talk about the style. Talk about your goals and what you're trying to achieve, and maybe how you get this product.
Yeah. So the sake that you're mentioning here is called the Diplomat. It's our flagship sake, and it's a Yamaha Ginjo. So very long, slow ferment. But it is also a Yamaha, so it tends to have a little bit more mouthfeel, more umami. It's going to have a little bit higher acid content. And the goal there really is just, again, to kind of marry those two kind of opposing forces in sake and make something that's really versatile, especially with food. In the South especially, food is not known for being subtle. As you mentioned, hot chicken is one of the stars of the show, but it goes on like that, so... Yeah, trying to make sake that really works with our region and what we're doing. It's also inspired by some of my favorite hard water sakes from Japan, who are also doing these very vigorous ferments, but long, slow, cold with harder water, and really driving some minerality into the sake as well. This one's super fresh, so it's still got a lot of brash, fruity nama nose on it.
And how would this change over time in the bottle?
So some of that fruit will kind of take a backseat to more of that umami. You'll start to get a little bit more on the palate and less on the nose. So we typically reserve a fair amount of our sake to age as well. So we have a couple of things over there that are about 3 years old right now. So people can see the differences as sake moves through the time continuum.
This is delicious. Give us your tasting notes.
This is I don't get to taste Byron's sake often enough, and it's cool because I feel like every time I taste your sake, I taste some changes, and I think probably what I feel like is improvements from the result of like practice and honing in and like dialing in your style. This is a little fruity, more like I get more fruity esters than I remember in the Diplomat. But what I love about Byron's commitment to the Yamaha style, which does allow some ambient microbes to come in the starter batch phase and make some tart acidity. He's balancing big things, and the Diplomat's balancing big things. I love this big style, and there's a lot of umami and there's a lot of just like depth to this sake. Actually, tasting it now, I get more complexity, I get more depth, and it's also just more really like overtly delicious. Although I will say the last Diplomat that you gave me was also delicious, but I just get more things going on with this in a really good way.
I love that. Yeah, and absolutely correct. Every batch is an iteration on the previous. So at this point, it's fine tuning, but my goal is to make every batch the best batch that I've ever made. So obviously a subjective statement, but you know, we learn something every time, and so we can tweak it ever so slightly.
Is this sort of an indication of the American influence on sake as a beverage? You know, is this like kind of, you know, letting American brewers' sensibilities loose on the beverage and kind of like, you know, would this be considered out of bounds as far as traditional sakes?
I don't think so, and in fact, I'm probably not the right person to ask, because I think most American brewers are traveling a different path than me. So I really fell in love with these older styles early on, and kind of came about that I started making it because I moved back to Nashville from New York, had no access to Yamaha sakes at all. So I started traveling to Japan, trying to learn the Yamaha techniques, and that's really what prompted this whole endeavor in the first place. So yeah, I think I'm the wrong person to ask on what American style sake is.
Yeah. I feel like that complements my answer about what is an American style. It's too early to say, but also you and I know that within Japan, there is a very diverse range of styles. More diverse than people know, and partly that it's understandable because it's hard to have access to a lot of Japanese sake. But if you are lucky enough to have access to it, there's such an interesting, fascinating range of styles and constant trying things, innovation, a curiosity about where can we go with it. And, I would love to see American sake get to the point where it even feels like we're really playing on the same level. Or like, I don't know, I feel like mostly we're just trying to make something that we're proud of and people really enjoy. And how it compares so much to Japan, like is it inside or outside of what's being done in Japan, I feel like we don't think so hard about. And mostly the idea is like, yeah, there's probably someone in Japan who's doing something like this. But if we do it long enough and enough people do it, something might emerge that really is like the American, whatever an American style would be. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly, everything I do in sake is certainly done as homage to all of the beautiful sakes and teachers and inspiration that I've taken from Japan. So I'm always hoping to make someone proud over there, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, excellent. Well, this was delicious. Thank you very much for your time, Byron.
Thank you.
And Ben, especially thanks for your time. I feel like I've had a master class this evening, just going around the tent with you and talking and tasting. I think my knowledge of sake has doubled in the past hour or so.
I love it. I will say your pronunciation has already improved from the beginning, and it's my pleasure. I love talking shop with you and your audience that I know loves getting into some details and loves interesting things. So my pleasure.
Thanks, guys, and good luck, and keep making great stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Ben for taking so much time with us. Ben really went out of his way to help. And thanks to Maggie at Origami for getting us access to the event. And thanks to Kelly Dodson for being my producer on the scene and helping me keep track of the timing as we went along. What a great weekend in my hometown. It was wonderful. What can I say? If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.